Welcome to my podcast. This is W. Stephen Saunders. I'm a licensed psychologist in the great state of Florida with over 21 years of experience. I'm an associate lecturer on the faculty at the University of Central Florida in the Department of Psychology. This podcast is a series of lectures given in my courses at the university. All content is copywritten and all rights are reserved. If you'd like to get in contact with me, you may do so by email at wstephensaunders@ucf.edu or call or text at 352-406-0506. Enjoy the podcast. This podcast was recorded August 26, 2019. It's the introduction to abnormal psychology. So, what's abnormal? What does abnormal mean? It's not a rhetorical question. I'm hoping to get an answer from you. What's abnormal? Out of the ordinary, okay? What else?
Something that goes against social norms.
Something that goes against social norms. Now, what's a social norm for those that may not know?
Polite to other people.
Polite to other people. Kind of what the majority of people do, right? Is a social norm. What we accept as social norms. Now, is social norms the same everywhere?
No,
of course. Even within the United States, we find that sometimes social norms may be a little different. You know, I grew up in the deep south in the panhandle of Florida, just below the Alabama-Georgia state line. And I grew up in a tiny little town called Bonifay, Florida, of about 3,000 people. And, you know, there everybody talks like this. And they're just as friendly as can be. How you doing, Shug? Come here, give me a neck hug. I hadn't seen you in ever. You know, and they give you a big hug. And, you know, how's it going? How's your mama doing? And you know, giving you just every little thing, want to know what's going on, right? Well, when I moved to Chicago, they do things a little different up there. And when I was trying to give people neck hugs and tell them how much I love them, they were like, what is your problem? Right? Different social norms in big cities than small towns, especially small southern towns. So yeah, so my behavior of what was completely normal in my little small town transplanted me fish out of water in Chicago, my behavior was very abnormal. So it went against social norms, right? What else is abnormal? And when we think about abnormal in psychology, you know, if you have a mental disorder, what does that mean? What does that mean to you? Well, what it means to me, and again, you know, feel free to pipe up about any of this stuff. But as a clinical psychologist, I'm actually not concerned whether or not my patients or my clients are normal. That I could care less about. What I am concerned about is whether or not they are functional in their life, and however they need to lead and live their life. So, you know, a person may be very eccentric. They may come in with a plaid shirt and striped pants and a crazy hairdo and sit down and do therapy, and you may, you know, immediately have a reaction to how outrageous their outfit is, but, you know, then you find out that they're and a rock and roll band, and this is just how they dress, and this is totally normal, you know, within the context of their life, and they're actually very high functioning, and they're not here for any kind of real abnormal thing. They're here to come see you because they need some evaluation about something. So what might be normal in one context is not normal in the other. And in the field of psychology, as a therapist, as a psychologist, I look at what's actually functional, not necessarily what's normal or abnormal. But for the purposes of the class, when we talk about abnormal, we're really talking about what's not functional in a person's life. Okay, so indicators of abnormality might be subjective distress. I don't like What's going on with me? You know, I don't like hearing these voices that are constantly talking to me. But I have had people who hear voices who like their voices just fine. And it's not subjectively distressing. It might be distressing for everyone around them, but not them. Maladaptiveness. You don't have the ability to adapt to the changing circumstances of your life. You know, whatever that might be. Statistical deviancy. So when we talk about statistical deviancy, so I'm going to draw you the famous bell curve. Have you all seen the famous bell curve? Right? So let's take a psychological construct that we call intelligence, for example. So this is the bell curve, and intelligence actually is equally distributed in North America along the bell curve. We define intelligence as it's measured by psychologists by what's known as the IQ, or the intelligence quotient. And we give that a number, and a number of 100 is the mean intelligence. What does mean mean from your statistical classes or your math classes? What does mean mean? The average. So if you took everyone in the United States, everyone in Canada, everyone in North America, averaged them together, they're going to have 100 IQ. So you go out one standard deviation away from the mean, plus or minus, and you get 115 on that side, you get 85 on the other side. When you go out two standard deviations from the mean, you get 70 on that side and you get 130 on this side. From 85 to 115, you have about 68% of the American population, North American population, that fall, their IQ falls in between 85 and 115. When you take two standard deviations out from 70 to 130, you have 95% of everyone in North America falls, their IQ falls in between 70 and 130. Only 2.5% of the population are above an IQ of 130. What do we call these people? No, we call them weirdos. No, we call them genius. Yeah, we call them genius. We call them intellectually gifted, a lot of different things. These folks down here, only 2.5% of the population fall under 70, which is considered to be intellectually disabled. They used to call this mentally retarded, but they've changed that terminology, and now it's intellectually disabled. The thing that a lot of people don't know, but psychologists know, if you've been in the profession for long enough, is that these people emotionally and these people emotionally are just as abnormal often. Is just as abnormal to be in the upper 2.5% of intellectual ability as it is to be in the lower 2.5% of intellectual disability. And you often find that they both have a lot of different emotional issues that go on. And sometimes these folks are actually a lot more neurotic than anybody else. Sometimes intelligence kind of kick your butt because you can see all of the world's problems on multiple levels, and it becomes overwhelming often. So, you know, abnormal, as defined in the construct of intelligence, would be into the extremes. So any kind of, you know, if you're two standard deviations away from the norm, either direction, you're abnormal by definition. That's statistical deviancy. Violations of the standards of society. So, you know, used to in the 70s, it was very popular to go streaking. You know, you'd take all your clothes off and you'd run across the football field. Everyone would laugh, ha, ha, ha. And, you know, you might get a ticket for lewd and lascivious behavior, but, you know, it really wasn't that big of a thing. Now, of course, you get put on the register, the sex offender register. It is a big, giant thing. Don't go streaking, right? And no one wants to see. Certainly not me naked. I would never do that. That would be crazy. So, but that's the violation of standards of society, running across things. You know, when
College students have a very wide range of what's considered to be acceptable dress for a college class. You know, and I've seen students wear everything from yoga pants and workout clothes to, you know, what I would see on in Sunday morning, you know, dress and everything in between. So, you know, you have a little bit wider range where if you're going on an interview, I'm a very capable and competent person, right? Yes. I'm certainly not violating the standards of society because I put on a button-down shirt and some slacks, and I've got my tie on and my coat. And my wife often says I have different personalities. There's Dr. Saunders when I'm at the office, right? There's Professor Saunders who's trying to be educational and entertaining. You know, and then when I go back up to Alabama to see my mom and daddy, there's just plain old Steve. Hey, mama, you got some pie for me? Yeah, sugar. Oh, Lord, sit down. Thank God you're here. Social discomfort, you know, what might that be? It depends on a lot of contexts. Sometimes people who have what's known as social anxiety may experience discomfort in parties. You know, I am an extrovert, so I love being in front of people, and I love entertaining. You know, and I play the ukulele, and at Christmas time, I'm playing the ukulele for my family, and we're singing songs together. My mom's on the piano, and we're all having fun. You know, that, for me, that's a lot of fun. But for someone with social anxiety, that is absolute torture. Like, just the thought of it would send them into panic attacks, just thinking about having to do that. Now, a lot of times I'm asked to predict dangerousness in a person. I'm a forensic psychologist. I worked for 7 years for the Department of Justice in the federal government in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And I continue to work in a forensic practice mostly. And often I will get asked, Dr. Saunders, this man is coming off a 10-year sentence. He was a serial sex offender. We want you to go evaluate him and give us a prediction about his dangerousness, right? So then when they say that, I take my wizard hat and I put it on and I get my crystal ball and I try to make some kind of prediction. The truth is that I cannot predict an individual's behavior with a really giant degree of certainty. Because people are more or less unpredictable. Now, here's a question for you. What do you think is the number one best predictor of someone's future behavior? Their previous behavior. That is exactly right. Their past behavior is the number one predictor of their future behavior. Because for the most part, most people have a consistent pattern of behavior that psychologists call personality. And this consistent pattern of behavior we can use to predict how they're probably going to act in the future. Now, despite all the crime shows and CSI and all the stuff we love to watch on TV, believe it or not, less than 1% of the population has ever, ever committed a crime. Less than 1%. It's hard to believe, but it actually is true. 99% of the people in America wake up, they pay their taxes, they go to work, they love their family, they're not slapping around their spouse or their kids, for the most part. And, you know, they live their life and they're pretty decent, good people. One of the reasons all those shows are so fascinating is because that behavior is so abnormal. It's so strange. It's very deviant to violate the norms of society to that level. So the only thing that I can really do is I can give a probability of recidivism or probability of dangerousness, low, medium, or high, based on their past behavior. And a lot of the latest tools in psychology is we're actually using what's known as actuarial tables. Same things that insurance companies use to predict
risk of a given insurance policy, right? So insurance companies, you got to pay more to insure your house against wind damage in Florida than you do in Montana. Why is that? There ain't no hurricanes in Montana, right? Maybe the occasional tornado or something, but not always. So trying to predict dangerousness can be difficult, but that also is an indicator of abnormality. So no one element is sufficient to define or determine abnormality. It's very true, and culture plays a role in determining what is or is not normal. You know, a good example is, as recently as the early 1970s, which doesn't seem that long ago for me, but may seem like a long time ago for you, but in cultural historic terms, it's really not that long ago. But as recently as the 1970s, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders still listed being gay or lesbian as an abnormal, deviant pattern of behavior that was diagnosable. Homosexuality, no longer is that considered to be a pattern of deviant behavior. They took that out. So because the culture changed. So the DSM-5 definition of mental disorder. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, published by the American Psychiatric Association. And the fifth edition is the latest edition, and that's what your book and all that is based on. So you got biological, psychological, developmental dysfunction in individuals. All of that can certainly play a role in whether or not they have a diagnosable mental illness. Clinically significant behavior, disturbance in behavior, emotional regulation, or cognitive function. You know, I know a lot of people who have high cognitive function who are very intelligent, but are very emotionally dysregulated, right? You know, often like a disorder like bipolar disorder is not a cognitive disorder, that's an emotional disorder. So, you know, you may have someone very intelligent, but they're bipolar, and so they have difficulty with their behavior sometimes. And then both can be associated with distress or disability. Now, every single one of these disorders that we're going to read about this semester are all on a spectrum. They all are. Every single one of us wake up some mornings feeling good, some mornings not so good. Right? Yes, ma'am.
Do you think all disorders are on a spectrum?
They're all on a spectrum, really. They all are. Even if the DSM doesn't explicitly state they're on the spectrum, they really all are on the spectrum. Because we all have what are known as shadow syndromes, or we have like a lesser degree or just symptoms of larger, what could be a larger diagnosis. So, you know, take depression, for example. Probably every single person in here at one point in your life have felt a little sad. If you haven't, that is abnormal in and of itself. But you probably have. You've probably felt the range of emotions. You felt sad. You felt anxious sometimes or a little nervous. You felt angry. You felt great periods of joy and ecstasy, I hope, you know, and great disappointments. And you felt all of those things. Those are all normal emotions that are within the normal range of human experience. It's when what's on that normal spectrum is suddenly outside of that norm. Just like intelligence is just one construct that you can fall outside the norm. You could say that about any construct. You could put, you know, emotion up here. You could fall outside the norm on emotion between feeling depressed, feeling anxious, feeling angry, feeling calm, all of those different things. So we all battle those at one way or another. What separates a person who's not diagnosed from someone who is diagnosed is often a measure of their functionality. There are a lot of people who wake up very depressed every day, but they still wake up, they get their kids dressed, they get them off to school, they clean the house, they're doing all their chores, they go to work. They pay their paycheck, they come home, you know, they're functional. A functionally depressed person, plenty of people out there like that. They may not really ever come to in to see someone until it gets to a point where they just can't function any longer. So the ICD-10, this is basically another classification system. Both the DSM and the ICD-10 use exactly the same coded codes, number codes, numerical codes, that you will learn all that stuff if you have to bill for insurance. So I used, in the ICD, I had all the ICD-9 codes memorized. And for psychology, I could tell you what they are by heart. Then they changed to ICD-10. And I'm like, why did you change the numbers? I had them all memorized. And so now I have to learn a whole new classification system. So it's another psychiatric classification system. These are the International Clinical Diagnostic Codes. That's what ICD stands for. It has similarities and differences with the DSM. It's now used in the United States and other countries. We were the last major country to adopt it, like we are for most things. You know, we're still not even on the metric system, and the rest of the world is. Although, I always have a hard time trying to figure out kilometers. So I don't, when you grew up with the old English system. So the classification systems provide a nomenclature and common language for everyone to understand. It allows for information structuring, it facilitates research, and it establishes the range of problems to address. Now, you know, a lot of times there's controversy. Some therapists will say, well, I don't give diagnosis because I don't want to label anyone, right? And honestly, there is some credence to that belief. Sometimes a person will over-identify with their disorder. I've had people show up in my office and go, hi. I'll say, hi, I'm Dr. Saunders. And they'll go, hi, I'm bipolar. Well, hi, bipolar. You know, what's your last name? Is that your first name or your last name, right? No, do not over-identify with your illness. You know, and I tried to get people not to do that. That is the danger of labeling. The benefit of giving a diagnosis is that often a person sometimes will struggle for a long time in their life trying to figure out, what is wrong with me? And once you give them a diagnosis, then they feel like, okay, now I've got a handle on this. I understand what's happening with me. I can grasp it. And before, something that seemed like really big and out of control now seems like something that they can work on. So, there's pros and cons to diagnosing someone, in the modern world, it's you pretty much can't get away from it, especially if you take insurance. Sometimes you have a loss of individual information. Again, a person like over-identifies, they stigma and stereotyping associated with the diagnosis. There are some diagnoses that if you ever get that diagnosis ever in your entire life, it might even preclude you from certain jobs. You know, like a person who's ever been diagnosed with a psychotic break, who's ever in a psychotic disorder of any kind, which is basically a detachment from reality, who's ever been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, either one of those, you are automatically precluded from holding a top secret security clearance. You're precluded from ever being any kind of job where the public safety is in mind. One of the things I do in my practice is I actually do pre-employment screenings for police officers. And, you know, why is that important? Well, you don't want a maniac police department, right? You don't want, or any more maniac than they already are. You certainly don't want someone with a severe mental illness being able to hold a gun and that sort of thing. So self-confidence is impacted by diagnostic labeling. We talked about that. So how do we reduce prejudice attitudes toward people who are mentally ill? I think it has certainly come a long, long way, much longer than a way than it used to be. I think in the millennial generation, it's really come a long way. Baby boomers in the old days, 50s and 60s, will go, you know, don't tell anyone I'm in therapy. Whisper that they're in therapy. Millennials will go, ha, 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 hey, you know what my therapist said the other day? Right? And they'll go off on it. And I see them all the time post like intimate details about their life and what's happened in therapy on Instagram or social media. It's really interesting. So network reactions are a widespread global phenomenon. You want to understand the neurobiological basis, but that doesn't seem to lessen the stigma, unfortunately, and contact with individuals does not seem to lessen the stigma either. I think often if you have a family member who has struggled with mental illness on some level, sometimes that can be helpful. If you yourself have struggled with mental illness, that certainly can be helpful with understanding it on some level too. But again, it often is a cultural kind of factor that plays into whether or not it is considered to be accepted or not. So there are certain forms of psychopathology that are highly specific to certain cultures, like in Japan. In Japan, they have a very different view of depression and even suicide, for example. In traditional Japanese culture, if you do something to shame yourself or your family's name, it's actually considered to be a way to regain face and regain your honor to kill yourself. You know, in traditional Japanese culture, it has changed quite a bit over the years. But even today, they have a suicide forest in Japan where people go to commit suicide. And it's just part of their culture. The government doesn't seem to be doing much about it. Latina from the Caribbean have their own set of cultural beliefs that might be a culturally relevant psychopathology. So planning, establishing, and funding mental health services for specific disorders can be important. We don't do that good of a job of that in the United States, particularly Florida, unfortunately. Epidemiology is the study of distribution of diseases, disorders, and health-related behaviors in a given population. And then prevalence, same thing, how much of a disorder is given in a particular time. What's the incidence level, number of new cases? And then what's the lifetime prevalence? On and on. What's the comorbidity? Comorbidity means you have more than one diagnosis. Often people who have severe mental illnesses will also have a substance abuse problem of some sort. Because one of the things that people do often when they have some kind of mental illness is they will seek out ways to escape that mental illness. So you may have someone who's an alcohol abuser, and it really depends on what their diagnosis is. People who are very depressed tend to like stimulants quite a bit. They tend to like marijuana, kind of mellows them out, you know, relax, listen to some Pink Floyd or whatever's your thing to listen to when you're doing weed. And even smoking weed is not even that big of a stigma anymore. You know, you can even get it as a treatment, medical treatment now. It's incredible. but you see a lot of that kind of comorbidity over time. So these rates of severe mental illness are higher in women, in people ages 26 to 49, and in some minority groups. Why do you think mental illness is higher in women than men? Do you think women are crazier? Why do you think it's higher? Yeah.
I think we're just more emotional.
You think women are more emotional.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a woman saying that, right? Y'all don't go home. You know what Dr. Saunders said? He said women are more emotional. No, I didn't say that. Go ahead.
Yeah, they actually seek help while men, like, they try to hide because of pride.
Yeah, and actually a lot of studies have shown that that's the case, that women tend to seek services for a wide range of problems and issues, where men, you know, you basically, I guess my leg's broke and I can't walk anymore and I'm dying and I've got a rope around my neck. I guess I better go seek services, right? It takes a much higher threshold for men to seek services. I think that a lot of studies have shown that that is changing, particularly in people ages 26 to 49. As we're getting into younger and younger generations, millennials and Gen Z, which is the generation just after millennials, the youngest generation, if you're 20 years old or younger in this class, you probably are Gen Z, not a millennial. They're more likely to seek services regardless of gender, whether they're men or women. So maybe that's good news. Some minority groups tend to have more prevalent. And sometimes that is not necessarily because there's something indicative in that particular culture or that particular race. It may be simply that they're getting overdiagnosed. Sometimes you have, there's a whole bunch of studies that show that, you know, for example, black men are more likely to be diagnosed with anger and impulse control disorders as opposed to white men. And sometimes it's who the raider is. It's who, you know, it's how it's being approached. It's what context this person is being seen in. If a person, regardless of their race or gender, is being seen in an outpatient private practice, or if they're being seen in the hospital. You know, if you're being seen in the hospital, you're almost always going to be diagnosed with a much more severe mental illness than you are if you're being seen in the outpatient office. Sometimes it's kind of common sense because if you're going to the hospital for a mental health problem, you're usually in the middle of some crisis situation of some sort. And often it's a Baker-actable kind of situation. In the state of Florida, they have this law called the Baker Act. And the Baker Act gives the police, mental health professionals, and physicians the authority to involuntarily confine you into a psychiatric hospital if you are in imminent danger. Now, what does that mean? Imminent danger. That means right now, at this moment in time, if I don't Baker Act you, you are going to harm yourself or harm someone else. The legislature of this past legislative session this year actually added a component of that to the mental health requirements that mental health professionals have to do. Now they have actually codified in law what's known as the duty to warn. So for example, if I have a woman who comes to therapy with me and she's coming for relationship problems, and here's our first session. So in the middle of the session, she goes, well, I tell you one thing, this is going to change because when I get home tonight, I got me a gun I bought at Walmart, and my husband is going to get a big blast of this shotgun right up his butt, right? And so, like, they say that, all right, the husband, I feel like now, is in imminent danger of harm from her, right? Not only am I now required to inform the police, I'm compelled to inform the police in that regard. I'm also required to make my best effort, to make what's known as a good faith effort, to locate, contact her spouse, and warn him what she said. Even though it breaks confidentiality, that is a legal requirement. And so that allows me to break confidentiality if she says something to that effect. Now, if I ever had a client who did say something like that, I would have a long conversation with them and make sure it's not said in jest, it's just not said out of frustration, or whether or not it really is true, you know. And sometimes I've had clients who've come to me and they're just like, I'm going to kill myself if you don't help me. And I'm like, we're going to the hospital. Thank you. And they've been happy to go to the hospital. They needed the help. And it was a literal cry for help. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at this. So you have to look at it like a scientist. So the burden of mental illness for different disorders across the lifespan, depressive disorders are probably some of the most prevalent disorders. There was a recent study that came out that said the United States population, and even perhaps the world population, is reporting more instances of depression than ever before. Why do you think that is?
People
might be more open to admitting it. Absolutely, that could be a part of it. What else? Yes.
The world sucks right now. It's making everybody depressed.
The world sucks, right? Or it appears to suck. You know, we are bombarded constantly by information. Bombarded. You know, and if you ever go to any retirement community, or like you go to my parents' house, they're obsessed with the 24-hour news cycle. You know, and they're watching CNN, they're watching Fox News, they're watching MSNBC, they're watching just around the clock. And in order to fill up all the time you have with these 24-hour news cycles, they got to report everything. Even things that used to be a local story, they're reporting it as national news. So it gives you the impression that things are getting worse and worse and worse. When in fact, if you actually look at the statistics of what is really happening in the world as far as humanity goes, number one, global extreme poverty is at an all-time low. Historically, in the history of humanity, it is at the lowest degree it has ever been. Hunger, starvation is at an all-time low. Believe it or not, individual wealth is at an all-time low. Did you know that if you make at least $25,000 a year, which don't seem like a whole lot of money in Western American terms, right? But if you make $25,000 a year, you are in the upper 20% of income earners in the entire world. There are millions of people who make far less than that and are, living their life, right? So, you think about the little things that we take for granted. We take air conditioning. And the fact that most of us have places to go and stay, that we have clothes on our back, that, we live in a country where obesity is an epidemic. We don't have to worry about whether or not we're going to eat tomorrow or not. That doesn't mean there aren't people in the country who aren't that way, but for the most part, that's the case. So, sometimes when you really dig into the actual meat of what's happening in the world, you realize things are not quite as bad as you think they are. You listen to the president, sometimes you're like, oh God, we're all gonna die, right? He's gonna, nuclear annihilation. But it's not quite that bad, not quite that way. So treatment, not all people receive treatment, unfortunately. A vast majority of treatment is done on an outpatient basis. And inpatient hospitalization is typically done in psychiatric units. I have a whole host of people who come to my private practice for a variety of issues and problems. Sometimes I have people come, and they come for one session, and they have the am I normal question. Am I normal? I do such and such before I go to bed. I had a woman who came to my private practice, and she said, my husband has been collecting his fingernails and his toenails for 5 years of our marriage. I haven't said a word about it. He keeps them in a box by his nightstand. I said, okay. I said, is he depressed? Is he anxious? No. Is he dysfunctional? No, he's a very, high income earner. He's doing great. I said, is he, harming you? No, we get along beautifully. He's a great father. He's a wonderful husband. I don't have any other issue with him. It's just one thing. It's driving me crazy. I haven't said a word to him, and I got to have some professional advice. What should I do? And I said, sometimes you just got to put up with the little things, right? If this is the only thing your perfect husband is doing, who's perfect otherwise, is doing, why worry about it? Let it go. Just put up with it. She goes, you know what? I am. That's some good advice, right? And then sometimes I'll get couples come in. And, you know, for a long time, right after 50 Shades of Grey, that book came out, I had these 50 Shades of Grey couples come in. And every time it was the woman, and she was like, well, I just read 50 Shades of Grey, and I realized that my sex life is just garbage. This guy over here ain't doing all the things I'm reading about. He needs to step up his game. And so she's bringing him in. He's like, oh, totally does not want to be there. And she's like, you know, you got to fix him. Do something with him because this just ain't working out. I got to have more than what's going on, right? So you're doing couples therapy about all that stuff. I don't get a whole lot of those anymore, thank goodness, but I got just a slew of them in when that book first came out. That was nuts. Then I got a whole different level of them when the movies came out. That was just, oh, crazy. My wife, when that book first came out, my wife got it, and we were on a cruise together. And I was reading a book about Jesus. And we're sitting out on the pool deck, and I got my book out, and I'm reading about Jesus. And it's got the words on it, Jesus. His life and, you know, the historical evidence for his life and ministry. I'm like, oh, this is, you know, a great book. I'm reading Jesus. And she's like reading 50 Shades of Grey. And this old man walks by, and he looks at my book, and he looks at her book, and he goes, y'all must have an interesting marriage. And kept on walking. And we do. We do have an interesting marriage. But, you know, there's a lot of different reasons people come in for treatment. Mental health professionals' diagnosis and assessment involves participants who play different roles in the process, certainly, and gather a comprehensive evaluation of the patient data is important. Types of mental health professionals, how many can you name? What are they? Psychologist is one, absolutely. Psychiatrist is one. Social worker, yep. Yeah, in the state of Florida, there's a number of people who work in mental health. You got psychiatrists who are medical doctors that are trained to treat mental illnesses from a medical perspective. Mostly that's drug therapy. It also can be ECT therapy, which is electric convulsive shock therapy. They still do that, believe it or not. They also have now what's known as transcranial magnetic resonance therapy, which is basically they put these two huge magnets. Have you ever seen the old William Shatner Star Trek episode where they had this brain machine and it turned, Shatner was in it, doing his thing. You know, it looks a lot like that. And it turns and they send magnetic pulses through your brain. And it's very similar in its benefit in the same way that electroconvulsive therapy is, but much, much less taxing on the body. And you don't lose memory like you do with ECT. And then they used to do a lot of brain surgeries for mental illness. Very, very rarely do they ever do brain surgery anymore for mental illness, only if it has a true neurological kind of reason. Often a brain tumor, or you have epilepsy, or something along those lines, will they go that drastic? So psychiatrists, you have psychologists, that's me. Psychologists are doctoral level professionals. Mostly, the biggest thing we do are comprehensive psychological evaluations, and then we use research and testing to make a diagnosis of this person, and then to try to answer some referral question that the person comes in with. Sometimes I have people come in off the street and they'll pay cash and they'll go, I want a full psychological evaluation. And you're like, well, sir, why do you want one? Because I want to prove to my wife that I ain't crazy. She said I was crazy and I needed therapy. And I said, I'm coming here and get me a psychological evaluation to prove that I ain't. And I went, okay, well, you probably are, given, you know, your attitude, but we'll see. So you have that. And then sometimes you have court-ordered evaluations. Sometimes you have evaluations, parents will bring their child in, you know, oh, Johnny is so smart, I think he's gifted. Can you do some gifted testing? You're like, sure. And then Johnny comes out with a 110 IQ. Like, oh, you're a terrible psychologist. I'm going to somebody else. Well, fine, but I mean, Johnny's smart. He can, you know, probably do anything he wants, but, you know, your IQ is what your IQ is. It's, I have all kinds of that kind of stuff. Sometimes people come in, they want to figure out a question. You know, what? Here are my symptoms. What's wrong with me? Sometimes I have referrals from physicians. And physicians will say, here is the list of symptoms for this patient. I want to know what their issues are. Sometimes I have evaluations that are referred from neurologists. They want a neuropsychological evaluation. And so a person's had a stroke in their left temporal lobe. They know they have something called aphasia, which is a disorder of language. And the neurologist wants to know, what kind of aphasia is this? Is it expressive aphasia? Is it receptive aphasia? Is it global aphasia? Is it pure word finding aphasia? What kind of aphasia is it? So there's all kinds of testing I can do to test for that. And so there's a number of things that psychologists do. Then you have licensed mental health counselors. That's a master level person that primarily does mental health evaluations and does counseling or psychotherapy. You have licensed social workers in the state of Florida. That's a master level professional who also can do mental health evaluations as well as counseling and work independently. But they see things from not only an individual perspective, but also from a social perspective, which makes sense in some ways. You know, I will get kids who will come in from the foster system and they will get an evaluation. And so I can write a beautiful evaluation about all the things that's going on with this child and the things they might need. But if this child leaves my office and they go back into the same dysfunctional family they were before that caused them to have the government have to come in and take them out of that family and put them in the foster system, you know, no matter how much individual therapy that kid gets, they're not going to get better necessarily until they leave that toxic system. Or maybe the family as a whole needs therapy. And so the parents might need therapy to learn how to be better parents. And the other kids might need therapy to help to create a more functional family system. Then you have, in the state of Florida, licensed marriage and family counselors, which do pretty much what their name implies. They do mostly couples therapy and family therapy, but they also do individual therapy. Then there's also nurse practitioners in the nursing profession who also work in the mental health field. You have actually psychiatric nurse practitioners who act just like psychiatrists who also do therapy. That's another avenue that some people forget that is in the profession. And then you have all these ancillary professions that surround mental health. You know, all family physicians are usually first line mental health people. You know, a lot of times a person will come in to their general family physician office with a bunch of complaints about feeling bad, and really they're depressed or they're really anxious. Pediatricians often will do that. I have a lot of referrals from pediatricians. Kids, when they're really young, don't quite have the language yet to articulate all of their, you know, intra-world. You know, a kid is not going to sit and say, I'm having an existential dilemma about the nature of existence and my crisis and my part in the world. I'm having panic attacks and anxiety. You know, they don't have all that language yet. Instead, the kid will say, I've got a stomach ache. I don't feel good. You know, that's how they're expressing their anxiety, for example, or something along those lines. So getting to know them. And then often clergy can also be people who are kind of the frontline mental health providers. Many times people who are very religious, who attend church, temple, or synagogue, will go to their clergy member to talk to them, and they may be getting the first bit of counseling with them, and then they will refer over to you. My little hometown where I grew up in, we didn't have any mental health therapist anywhere in the town. In fact, you had to drive all the way to Tallahassee or all the way to Panama City, which was like over an hour away, to even find anybody in the mental health profession. Instead, if you were feeling depressed or bad, you went to the church and you got prayed through. Now, you know what I'm talking about. She's over there nodding. Yep, I've been prayed through, she says. Yeah, and you know, basically being prayed through as you go up in front of the church, everybody lays hands on you, and they don't let go until you have an emotional catharsis of some sort. Oh, Lord! And then you fall out in the spirit or something. And, you know, people find that helpful. So I certainly don't discount all of that, but I'm also a believer in the science of mental health. So benefits of research is trying to understand all of this stuff better and really being able to figure out and put together what are known as evidence-based therapies. If you look at the history of therapies in the mental health profession, you will find all kinds of wacky therapies that have happened over the years. Primal scream therapy was one in the 60s, where you know, the thought was that society so is keeping you locked down that you just cannot let your most primal emotions out. So if you just scream out of the top of your lungs and you let all your primal emotions out, that's going to create a big burst of energy, and you're gonna feel a lot better. And you know, you go all the way back to Freud and his stuff, and then all over the years, there's been dozens and dozens of different kinds of therapies. One of the things that we have found that all the mental health therapies have in common is that the more you talk about your behavior and your emotions, the more your behaviors and emotions change. It's just the way humans are built. And when you have someone who will listen to you, you know, it's really a sad commentary on our society in some ways, that people pay me, you know, like $100, $150 an hour just to listen to them for an hour, right? And often that's all I do. I'm just listening. Sometimes I might offer advice judiciously if I feel like that's appropriate, but often I don't. And sometimes I'm just listening and trying to figure out what even the problem is. Because sometimes even the client doesn't know, at least consciously. I'm a believer that they probably know unconsciously, but you have to kind of really listen to figure out what they're really even saying or what their overall problem really might be. So there's a lot of different ways to approach all of this, but one thing that all mental health really has in common is that there's a relationship, a very unique relationship between the patient or the client and the therapist. And that's a unique relationship that doesn't really exist in any other context in your life. You know, because when you have a friend that you tell a problem with, that might be great, but your friend often is just waiting for you to shut up so they can tell their story, right? You know, or you tell your family member, that can be helpful, but, you know, suddenly they're Googling naturopathic cures, and now you've got all these essential oils that you're rubbing on yourself because Aunt Martha said this is the way path to healing. And you're like, man, this cinnamon oil really burns. He goes, you're not supposed to put that on your skin, says Aunt Martha. You're like, oh, well, now you tell me, right? All right, so sources of information in psychology, you have case studies, self-report data, which is the biggest thing. In private practice, that's the biggest thing, is just the data the patient themselves report. Of course, when you're a forensic psychologist, sometimes you have your client who is self-reporting data that's not wholly truthful, right? They're doing something called malingering. Do you know what malingering means? Malingering means you are faking symptoms for a perceived secondary gain. I had a guy on death row. He had murdered his wife. And he had murdered her in kind of a gruesome way. They got into an argument. He had been kept up for about 4 days by her. Every time he tried to go to sleep, she would throw things at him. She was high on methamphetamines, and so she didn't need to sleep. And she was getting crazier and crazier from her lack of sleep and her drug use. And he was getting crazier and crazier from his lack of sleep and his pre-existing, well-documented history of psychosis, including a previous diagnosis by two healthcare professionals of schizophrenia. And he finally got enough of her. He even had a conversation with his father that the father taped. I'm not sleeping. She won't let me sleep. You've got to come get me and get me out of here. He was like 1,000 miles away. His father was up in Connecticut. He was down here in Florida. And he's asking his father. His father was so concerned about him, he taped the conversation, which was great evidence for this guy. He finally got fed up with his wife. His wife threw a vacuum cleaner at him. He got up. He ripped the cord off the vacuum cleaner. He wrapped it around her neck and yanked it. She passed out. He went to sleep. And when he woke up, she had been dead for several hours. No way to revive. He calls 911 in a panic. Oh my God, my wife is dead. What do? I don't know what happened. I think I did it. Oh my God, oh my God. Calls the father, same thing. And, you know, they show up. Of course, he's arrested for second-degree murder. So they don't think it was premeditated. Rather, second-degree murder means it's not premeditated, but you still did it with criminal intent. You basically are doing something bad. You're killing this person, not in defense of yourself or someone else, but you're just killing this person without premeditation. I went and did a whole evaluation of this guy and did a long investigation on this whole case. And I talked to the father. I talked to his previous psychiatrist and therapist. I got all of his previous reports. I had a wealth of information on this guy. Plus, I did a lot of research on sleep deprivation. What does sleep deprivation do to you? You know, and honestly, there's evidence that even if you have been deprived of sleep for just 48 hours, a normal person who has no history of mental illness, who's been sleep deprived for 48 hours, will begin to hallucinate, have poor judgment, get irritable, become impulsive. That's for an average normal person with no mental health history. This guy had a big mental health history, and it was documented that he had been awake for 72 hours. So it was a pretty slam dunk case of not guilty by reason of insanity, I thought. And that's how I wrote up the report. And then when I got depoed by the prosecution even was, I could tell they were like, this is a great case for the defense and not for the state. So they actually offered this guy a plea deal. And they allowed him to plead guilty to manslaughter, and they offered him 10 years in prison, which his lawyers said, take it, take it, take it, because otherwise, if we go to trial on this, you are looking at a lifetime in jail. He actually wasn't on death row. I think I said death row at the beginning. He actually wasn't on death row, because you're not on death row for second-degree murder, but it is a lifetime maximum imprisonment with no possibility of parole kind of thing. So instead he got 10 years in prison, which is a much shorter sentence for someone who's killed somebody with a vacuum cleaner. And the funny thing was, as I did the whole evaluation, it was very serious. And at the end of it, I said, just out of curiosity, you know, why did you kill her? Why didn't you just walk away? Like, why did you kill her? And he goes, because she wouldn't shut up. And then I couldn't help it. I just burst out laughing. I'm like, ah, ha, ha. And, that, and he goes, and then he started laughing. He started, ah, and he goes, yeah, we've all been there, haven't we, Doc? And I'm like, no, we haven't all been there. Sorry, I haven't killed my wife with a vacuum cleaner cord. I've thought about it, but I've never done it, right? So, all right, we are at our break time. I like to take a break after I've been talking for a while because I need one too. So let's take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and finish up.